ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Top down, bottom up, self-caused, uncaused, has anyone ever shown, realistically, how evolution could have done what its proponents say it did? Hello, I'm Tom Gilson, and today on ID the Future, we hear Dr. Michael Behe, originator of the question of irreducible complexity, fielding questions on it from philosopher Pat Flynn and Flynn's co-host Jim Madden. It's the second of three parts from a discussion that first aired on Flynn's YouTube channel.
A couple times you've appealed to linguistic analogies with language, right? Mm-hmm. I'm inclined off the cuff without giving it a lot of thought to say, yeah, if you're going to say this, this sentence, this proposition is in fact bearing intentional content, then it's going to be difficult to say that the process is bringing it about, right? Don't bear intentional content. Unless, though, you already have a kind of top-down causation, like if the sentence is a step in a conversation, and the prior steps in the conversation have a top-down effect on what goes on at the lower level, right? Then that might be a different case. But I think that's probably not relevant in what you're talking about, because you're mainly talking about, like, how do we get the bacterium off the ground in the first place, right? You're not really talking about succession, right?
Right.
Does that make sense? So I'd say that once you have an organism up and running, I think you could, if somehow you got one up and running without intentional processes, but intentional processes came up at a higher level, they could have downward causation, and they're kind of running it top down now rather than bottom up, right? Which actually, I want to talk epigenetics later too. But I'll say this though, it just about using the analogies with language is, we went in for the sentence you spoke because we had a pre-given sense of Latin pronunciation and the role that sentence could play in a conversation, right? We were already participants in a meaningful language game before you use that example. And it's that prior participation that let us recognize that as linguistic. It wasn't just the complexity of the stuff arranging. It was that we were already up and running in the language game to recognize that, right? And I wonder if critics, though, when you say, hey, you know, in the same way that we can recognize phonemes forming words, forming sentences, right, we should be able to recognize, you know, proteins and lipids forming, you know, more complex things, forming organelles, forming organisms as structured. But in the language case, it's that there's already a background understanding of what we may or may not be being told that we're bringing to the field that lets us recognize the meaning, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas that it seems like we can't front load it with the expectation in the biological case. Does that make sense? So I think that analogy is going to break down there, right? And because that's not exactly how language works. We don't build up from phonemes, right? Right.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure I agree. We do have, well, with the development of science, we now do understand a number of physical principles and engineering principles that are necessary to make machinery work. And right. What we find in the cell is machinery. And just to go back to the bacterial flagellum again, we know how you make a rotor, and we know what parts are needed.
But we don't infer intentional design of the parts to the whole from speech, because I don't intentionally design my speech from parts to whole. Okay. Whereas what you're asking us to do here in the analogy is to infer intentional design from parts to whole in the case of machinery. And I agree with you, in the case of machinery, we do this, but we don't do this in the case of speech, right?
That's true, because we have a lot of experience with it. But if you went to another planet, say, and there was some strange looking creature going, well, you might start to try to build that up exactly that way. And you'd say, how intelligent is this creature? If you did, you say, well, it says, it turns out that means, you know, food or something. Well, okay. Is it smarter than that? And if it could make more and more and more,
it could. It's not going to work, though, at the level of phoning up, right? It's going to work at the level of they're going to make certain noises in certain semantic situations that I'm going to make a charitable assumption about what they're doing, right? So I'm actually going from I'm imposing my whole interpretation on their world, right, and working down, and then I'm going to test that. Do you see what I mean? It's not going from pieces up, right?
Well, it's not, you would have to have a number of pieces first, and you would say, it's not just it's ba, cha, or something. When they put those together, when they arrange those together, they and you now discover that they mean food.
And is it not just pieces, but again, I would say relationality, right? And that's kind of what's unique about language is there's, you know, if you analyze the sentences we've used, there's only few words that we could actually put images or pictures to, right? And it's the ones we can't put images and pictures to that differentiates from the monkeys, presumably, right? It's the distinction between the perceptual and the conceptual ideas. So is it really not just about the parts, but the relationality, right?
Yeah. Design is the purposeful arrangement of parts, like in the mouse trap. You know, each part by itself, when they are arranged, they have this function now, and we can immediately tell that it was purposely designed.
Yeah. But see, I guess what I'm disagreeing with is not that. Okay. Right. It's this idea. So I agree that we humans have this theory of mind that comes pretty hardwired with us, right? Where from certain phenomena, we infer, not explicitly, but we seem to operate under a practical assumption that what we're talking to is smarter than us, as smart or smarter than us. Right. This is an integral to human cognition. Right. But we don't do that by assembling bits of phonemes, right? Or even pieces of faces, right, into faces and then thereby making the inference, right? It always begins from an overall gestalt and works down, right? And even using the example of the radical translation case, right? I mean, it's like we don't learn language like one piece at a time. We don't say, you know, this is green, Johnny. This is blue, Johnny, right? Because that presupposes I'm not talking about vessels, or I'm not talking about liquids, or I'm not talking about all these other things, right? So language always works like a whole interpretation down, not from pieces up, right?
Well, that's if we think that we're already speaking to an intelligent being. If we didn't know if this being was intelligent... Well, Here's an interesting story that I wrote about in Darwin Devolves. Yeah. It has to do with this editor, a French editor of the magazine Elle, and he had a stroke in the 1990s or so, and he couldn't move. He was in a hospital bed. He couldn't move a muscle except for his left eye. He could blink. And he dictated a book called The Butterfly and the Diving Bell about his experiences as a paralytic. He had something called locked-in syndrome that allows somebody just to blink an eye. Now, anybody walking by his hospital bed, you'd think he was a vegetable. Don't know. He couldn't make any phonemes. He couldn't do anything. He worked out a code with a translator in order to make his book. And we could tell his level of intelligence. You know, he could have any level of intelligence after his stroke, you know, from what it was before to, you know, nothing. We could tell his level of intelligence by interpreting the arrangements of his winks, And
but they already had French up and running, though, right? I mean, like the other person could come in and say, if you can hear what I'm saying, blink once, right? And then you know, and then build from there. So they're already
there's already a background
French that they're operating in, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so
that is a purposeful structure as well.
Well, so I mean, but French isn't purposeful in the sense that somebody sat down and designed it.
Well,
I mean, nobody's running French.
It is purposeful in the sense that anybody who uses it chooses their words in order to convey information. And you can do that with French. If the person you were talking to was deaf, you could use sign language. You could try to arrange pieces of, you know, something to, you could rub your belly to say that you were hungry.
Yeah.
All of those things though, are you're doing those for a purpose.
Yeah. I agree with you. Yes. I don't want
to get stuck too much on human language, because that's not, you know, as you know, directly applicable to biology, you know, unless you want to talk about DNA and the information in DNA.
Yeah.
But yes.
So I guess one thing I'll just maybe as a, and then Jimmy, get the final thought on this, so we can move to it, to another one. Cause I think that there's a lot of interesting lines of thought in here. Right. And I've been thinking about language and concept possession and this or that, and maybe just about concepts in general is really fascinating to evolutionary theory. Right. So the idea, one of the arguments for the immateriality of conceptual thought is its determinate or exact content. Right. Which speaks against materialism, because anything material is limited, it's imperfect, right? There's always any number of ways that we can conceptualize over and above the physical facts, right? So it seems like the space of causes can't fix the space of reasons, right? And so there's this sort of determinate and ambiguous exact content that comes with conceptualization that cannot be reduced to the physical. Now, it seems to me in evolutionary theory that this is assumed when we say that something is selected for, right? You see what I'm saying? Like there seems to be a fact, a determinate fact of the matter, even within evolutionary theory itself. Now that's teleology, right? That's a different argument that you're making, Mike. But I mean, unless. And I don't know, do scientists ever say that there's no fact of the matter of what's been selected for, or is it?
Oh, they say that a lot. Yeah. They will say it's selected for survival. And if it happens to be because it's resistant to some antibiotic, they might say that. But of course, it's a tenet of evolutionary biology that there is no such thing as real purpose.
Right. But take your polar bear example, right? Is the polar bear selected to be white, or is it selected to suit its environment?
Yes.
There's a difficulty here, right? There's a difficulty. I don't know. That might be unrelated and get us too far off the matter. But it seems to me that in order to really cash out and make sense of what's going on, even in biology, we're going to have some type of meaning when we talk about selection and mutation, right?
Yeah.
And that I think even just that meaning itself speaks of conceptual ideas, right? Now that's different than Mike's argument. So I don't want to take us too far aside, but I think it connects at least to some of the stuff that you brought up with language, Jim. So I'm trying to be a bridge builder here. You see?
Oh no. I'm having fun talking about it, so there's no. Yeah.
So I want to hear about epigenetics. What do you think about?
Sure. Okay. I wanted to look some of this up before we chatted, but then we had to move it up. So if I am like completely botching the scientific side of this, please like point me out to be the ass that I am. Okay. But I recently had read something about I want to say it's the PAX7 gene that is related to, I think, was it eye growth, right?
Yes.
Okay. And the idea was, is if you took the past seven out of a mouse and you like put it in like, you know, the hind quarter of a fruit fly, it won't grow a mouse eye. It will grow, you know, a fruit fly eye in its butt now. Right. Okay. And likewise, if you took it out of the fly and you put it in the hind quarter of the mouse, it's going to grow a mouse eye on the haunch. Okay. Not a fly eye. All right. Okay. I find this absolutely fascinating in terms of like a counterexample to the selfish gene business. Okay. Because now that gene's work is determined by its position in a whole living thing, right? Mm-hmm. Or it's partially determined, right? It's a two-way thing now. And so it's not just that this organism is at the service of the gene, right? The gene is as much at the service of the organism too now, right? That that indeed there is a downward causation on the gene from the living thing, and it's not all bottom up, right? And so now you've got living things with a kind of autonomy from the supposed genes they were selected for, right? And to me, that's kind of a game changer, right? So it's a different problem than what you're worried about, this is all assuming we've got things up and running, okay? But it would seem to show, like, once you've got stuff up and running, to say that it's simply we're going to read this off of the and you get all these like bad teleological metaphors built into this, like what the genes want to do, where the genes want to go, all that dead letter, right? Because indeed, it seems like that you can say the organism has just as much a case for running the show as do the genes.
That's absolutely correct. As far as I'm concerned, there's a whole new field of biology in the past 20 years or so called systems biology.
Yes. Yeah. I get a flutter when you say it, Mike.
Systems like systems engineering, you know, are engineer things. The interesting thing about the PAX 7 is that it's pretty much like a switch, you know, like a light switch or something. Mm-hmm. Okay. You unscrew the light switch from the wall here, take it over, put it into a different, you know, circuit, and it works. Okay, it's works, and it'll turn on whatever that new circuit is hooked up to do. But by itself, it's not doing much. It's just a tiny piece in a organized system. Okay. And if the organization weren't there already, it wouldn't do anything.
Right.
So
no, would it ever have been selected for, right?
Well, it wouldn't even, you wouldn't, if it weren't there or something else, it wouldn't be selected for, none of the other stuff would be selected either, at least in regards to the eyeball, which perhaps you can see is the problem with Darwin's theory of gradual, you know, building up of stuff.
And have you heard a term, I'm going to probably botch the pronunciation, autopoiesis? Associated with a biologist named Valeria.
Yeah, autopoiesis. But tell me more. I haven't followed it close.
The idea is that, and it's actually you can find this in Kant's Third Critique. It's like, although I don't know that that's where Valeria's taking it from, but I know some of his followers have made the connection. This idea that what an organism is, or a living thing is something where the parts of it cause each other, right? Now once again, your question, how the hell do you get that off the ground? Okay. But the idea is you know, this enzyme is there and it does what it does only because it's interaction with this other enzyme doing what it's doing. Okay. And so now at least Kant looks at this and he says, well, these organisms in a way are self-caused, right? Because all of their parts only make sense together, right? They only make sense together, okay? And then also, this is where these people of Valeria go with this, is to say, well, look, what happens then is these parts determine what is or is not informational to that organism in its environment, okay? Mm-hmm. It's because the parts are determining each other in this way that a certain thing is a nutrient as opposed to a poison to this particular organism, right? Mm-hmm. So now I think this is very interesting from how we make sense of, say, so-called randomness in evolution, because now it's not just environmental push on the organism that's running things. It's also the way the organism structures itself, right, that creates what is or is not a meaningful part of its environment. Do you see that? And so, like, once again, it's seeing organisms as having a kind of autonomy, not just from their genetics, but even from their environment in a way, or a kind of determining what is or is not a meaningful part of their environment is based on this internal dependence of the parts on the whole, right?
Right. Absolutely. Organisms, animals, and plants have, you know, built into them ways to adapt to their environment. If the environment changes, if it gets hot, you know, dogs shed fur. Yeah. When it gets cold, they grow more fur. And yeah, there are surely more complicated examples.
Yeah.
But, you know, if a meteor comes in, there's not much a dog can do to survive in the environment. So yes, it is the organism which determines what is a signal, yeah, and what is random.
Right.
And that's certainly the case, but that's certainly the case. Yeah. I was in a meeting recently between biology or ID folks and engineers sympathetic to ID. And they were saying that, yeah, we get a lot of closed systems that are closed all the time, or one part works on another, which it works on another. Yeah. And it's auto.
Yeah, it was the phrase I was looking for was closed. Yeah.
Yeah. But they say it gets there because we make it. Yeah. It doesn't make itself.
Yeah. It didn't call. Yeah. I always push back on, like, the self-caused idea, because that always it hurts the brain to think of something causing itself. Yeah. But I know that wasn't exactly what you meant by it, Jim. It just means there's a sort of,
it's Kant's phrase. Yeah.
There's an explanatory vicious circle in these types of situations. Right.
And, you know, something that strikes me right now is, okay, so to me, because of my kind of Aristotelian commitments, like, these are kind of the important issues to me is to see the organism as having an integrity over and above its genes, over and above its environment.
Right. Right, that it has a substantial form, right?
Yeah, it's a substance. But what's interesting, and this is probably a blind spot to my own Aristotelianism, Mike, is, you know, Aristotle does not deal with the problem of origins of these things, because he doesn't think there was one. He thinks the universe is eternal, and he thinks all the species are eternal, right? So you never in Aristotle get a question of how you got the first one, right?
Uh-huh.
And even in Aquinas, because he's pretty comfortable with, you know, a discrete single, you know, one morning God makes the universe boom thing, right? Uh-huh. So he's not really interested in a complex scientific story of how you got your first one, right? In a lot of ways, these problems that we're bringing up here don't really occur to that kind of Aristotelian classic tradition, right?
Right.
And how we adjust to that, it's an interesting question. And I hadn't thought about that problem just till this very moment.
Right. Some of these explanatory vicious circles are interesting because at least Aquinas would say, well, we have certain composites, right? Like a matter form composite where you can't make sense of it just looking at the matter form composite, right? Something beyond it has to have put these parts together, right? Yeah. And that is a purposeful arrangement of parts in a broadly, you know, loose sense, a more metaphysical sense, or essence and existence, for example, for Aquinas. Now, I wonder, Mike, if you have other examples of this. And I know we were chatting through email. I'll just throw it out there. We don't have to talk about all you want, but replication always seems to strike me as maybe one of these issues in biology, because the way I see it is this, right, is that to really make sense of evolution, you need a channel of communication, right, to pass down these traits. However, it seems to me an assumption that channel of communication is something that evolution is supposed to explain, right? So now we have an issue again, right? Like, we need this channel of communication, but to explain this thing, but this thing that needs to be explained is supposed to explain the channel of communication, right? Which is replication. And I don't know. I've really tried to look for good answers to this riddle. And of course, you go to origin of life sciences, and there's just all these spec. Well, maybe there's proto replication, or like there's a parallel to philosophy of mind, Jim. Like, you know how you have fading qualia in philosophy of mind. They have like fading replication in a sense. Actually, John Haldane makes this the example, yeah. right? And in the same sense, if you think that fading qualia doesn't make any sense, you definitely shouldn't think that fading replication makes any sense. So it just seems like there's like an in principle explanatory problem with that. Not just like a very improbable, and I'm fine with probabilities too. Like if something just seems so improbable, I'll reject it. But it seems like there's certain points that are just in principle issues. So Mike, any comments you have on that? And then where would you classify your arguments? Do you think it's just a matter of enormous improbability to the extent that it's just, yeah, it's just so improbable. We should just go where the evidence leads just because of that. Or do you think it's more than that? You think it's an in principle problem?
Well, let me first say that about replication, that I think that's a great example of Jim's autopoiesis, that, you know, one causes the other, that talking in terms of biology, we need DNA and we need the proteins that it codes for that actually do the work to replicate the DNA. And with Origin of Life, people will these days talk about RNA and the RNA world, where they fancy that RNA can act as a catalyst and also as a genetic information carrier. So maybe somehow that got together. And there's, as I'm sure you've seen, if you've looked into the Origin of Life literature, there's enormous problems with any of these scenarios. Mm-hmm. But the problem is they're empirical ones. And so you can't say, you know, you can't definitively rule them out in the sense of a mathematical proof or a philosophical proof. Mm-hmm. And you also have to realize that no matter how bad it gets, no matter how many things don't seem to work, a materialist will always have something else to say. They will never run out of ideas. So at some point, you just have to shrug your shoulders.
Right.
In a sense, irreducible complexity is the same problem as the origin of life, in that you have to get the genetic information for it, and you've got to get the thing itself. Mm-hmm. And like the origin of life, people say, well, maybe this happened first and helped a little bit, and then this helped a little bit more. But when you ask for details, they are not forthcoming, or they're only hand-waving.
Right. So maybe we could give an example. Like this came up in the discussion you had with Dr. Swaminathan, exaptation. Right. This is probably one of the most common ones, right? Well, maybe this thing was co-opted from over here, and then this thing was brought in from over here, and then they somehow rearranged one thing, shortened, and then they coordinated to an entirely new function. Now, to me, again, I've always found this completely unbelievable. I mean, if you just replace all that with the word magic in a textbook, I don't know if you lose any meaning whatsoever in terms of an explanation, but maybe you could build on that a little bit, right?
Well, with things like that, with exaptation or other things, the problems only occur when you start to look a little more below the surface. Then they never happen. And as I talked about in Edge of Evolution and in Darwin Devolves, these fancy processes that are invoked are nowhere to be seen in nature when we're looking at evolution in real time. I talk about the development of resistance to chloroquine by malaria in Edge of Evolution, and there were an enormous number of opportunities for something to happen, and yet the only thing that was effective was a small change in one protein. And in Darwin Devolves, I talk about Richard Lenski's experiments with E. coli, the bacterium E. coli, growing it for, you know, 50,000 generations just to see what would happen. And it improved. It grew faster. It did lots of stuff. But it did so by breaking genes. It didn't get any new gene. It didn't get any new molecular machine, nothing like that. So when you look for these things, they aren't there.
Right.
And it all boils down, I think, to purposeful arrangement of parts, because blind processes can't arrange anything on purpose. By accident, you know, something might fall next to this here, and that might help a little bit. But if you need you know, a bunch of parts to make a mousetrap, even a simple little mousetrap, which is, you know, a toy compared to the molecular machinery in the cell. You know, in 25 years, I still haven't seen a convincing, even on paper, explanation for how you could develop a mousetrap step by step in a Darwinian-like fashion. So at some point, at least in science, you got to, you know, say that, no, this doesn't work anymore. And look
at it. Can I ask you a question with the mousetrap metaphor?
Sure.
I've heard an anecdote about, like you can like break a piece off the mousetrap and like use it as a tie clip, or, you know, you could use it as a piece of jewelry or something like that. And I've often heard these objections to ID to say, well, look, I mean, maybe all these other prior parts have played, you know, life conducive roles in prior versions of the organism, or, you know, in that organism stream. And therefore, it was selected, like all these parts could have been selected for other reasons, right? And then were together in the gene pool of an organism when they came up as useful in conjunction, right? Do you find those objections at all plausible?
No, I think they are just meant to distract from the problem. I discussed this in Darwin's Black Box way back in 1996. I says, well, suppose you wanted to build a mousetrap from just, spare parts that were lying around a garage. Mm-hmm. And so for the baseboard, you took a wooden plank you had. Okay. And for a spring, you look around, well, there's a spring in the grandfather clock over here. I'll take that. And maybe for the holding bar, I've got a crowbar over here. Mm-hmm. But of course, those wouldn't work together to make a mousetrap. You've got to fit them to each other. They have to have the same proportions. They have to be very closely matched. And none of those other things, since they already have jobs to do, they're going to be fit for their jobs, not for the job of making a mousetrap. So instead, the problem is switched to having to adjust all of these things, having to form them, and you still won't have a functioning mousetrap until all of those parts are fit to each other.
And
the other thing.
Yeah. Finish your thought. I'll chime in. Yep.
Yeah. The other thing is Ken Miller of Brown University talks about the tie clips, and he says he can use other things as paperweights. But I would like you to go back home, or maybe you're home already, and find a tie clip in your door and ask yourself, is this on the way to becoming a mousetrap? Mm-hmm. I asked Ken Miller the same question at the New York Academy of Sciences way back in the early 2000s. I actually asked the audience, and I says, does anybody have a tie clip that looks like it's a mousetrap? And if you do, you probably don't get many dates. The point is that a tie clip would be fit to its job of clipping ties. It wouldn't be fit to be a precursor to a mousetrap. The other things he talked about any part could be used as a paperweight, he said. But, you know, if you look online at paperweights, none of them look like a piece of a mousetrap. So one problem with, you know, minds is that these guys are intentionally guiding things. They say, he's challenging us to make a mousetrap. So, okay, we'll start with this and we'll guide it all this way to form a mousetrap. And they are the intelligent agent then that is essentially building the, the mousetrap.
Honest, scientific layman's question. Do I have to assume, though, that in order for something to be selected as a tie clip, it would have to function optimally as a tie clip as opposed to some other role it might play accidentally in the future? Like, it could be a pretty bad tie clip, but just good enough to get like an ugly date, right? And it would still, right? It would still keep things running, right? I mean.
It would, but now suppose that you've got your ugly tie clip and somehow it gets bent or something. And selection would make it, would form it to be a better tie clip.
Right.
It wouldn't allow, it wouldn't cause it to remain as clunky. It would have no, there would be no selection to select it to be a part that will later be added to a mouse trap. So selection, I argue in Darwin Devolves, is actually a problem for Darwinian evolution, because it is expected to hone different parts for their present role, not for a future role, not for a past role, for right now. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they're not going to be, to the extent that they can be specific, they're going to be specific for their current role and not for some putative future role.
Right. And this is where I wanted to say just two quick things. One is, it was actually, yeah, because when I was first looking at ID, you know, I always try to say, what are the best objections, right? Because objections are argument testers, right? And whatever else anybody agrees or disagrees with here, I think we can all agree that we don't want to believe something that's false, right? Can't imagine anyone argue with that, right? So I'm the same way. Like, I try to look up what are the best objections, and Ken Miller came up right away, and the mouse and the tie clip stuff comes up. And I have to say, it was finding those not just unconvincing, but seeing that these were considered some of the best objections was really surprising to me, because my initial kind of impression of ID was, this is just dumb pseudoscience, right? So like, this should be easily refuted. And then I get this impression that, well, it's not, maybe it could still be refuted, but it's not being easily refuted. So there's something of a, you know, the PR on this is kind of off a little bit, right? So it just starts making me want to look deeper into it. And then I start looking into the details, right? And I'm like, oh, okay, this tie clip thing doesn't seem to work for a couple of reasons. One is that the fitness and the specificity of the parts really matters. But then again, there's the number of parts and them all being co-opted towards a new function that just seemed to me, if that, like, how can you do that, right? Like, how could that ever, because like an outboard motor, right? That's what we're talking about, the flagellum, right? The parts have to be well fitted, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but they have to be well fitted, right? And they're coordinated toward a particular function. How could you ever grab how many ever different parts from functions they're already serving that aren't fitted for that particular role, and then coordinate them together to perform a completely different function? I've never heard a good explanation for that. I've looked, but these sort of like just so stories, I agree. Like they only seem to work if you just don't look into the detail. And then once you start to kind of look more into the details, I think that they quickly start to lose their plausibility in many cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's poignant to read the literature on the flagellum from people who are just working on the flagellum. And there's one Japanese researcher, Kichi Namba, I've forgotten exactly what his name is. Yeah, I think this paper is from 2020 or 2021, very recent, that shows, you know, the flagellum actually has gears in it. It works by a geared mechanism. And at the end, essentially, he says, we see the divine complexity and elegance of it. But he said, I'm a materialist. So I just say, you know, it's wonderful what evolution can do. And that's it. Nobody has shown boo about how these things could have evolved in some realistic fashion.
We've just heard part 2 of 3 in a conversation where philosophy meets science on the topic of evolution and design. That was Dr. Michael Behe, hosted by Pat Flynn and Jim Madden on Flynn's YouTube channel, and republished here with his permission. For more outstanding conversation on evolution and intelligent design, stay tuned here at ID the Future, and please be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast app. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.